This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
HD Smartcast.
You are listening to a Mint production brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hello, welcome to our podcast, The Signal
and the Noise,
that will attempt to give you a peek into the inner workings of Mint's long story. This is Sunit.
And I am Ajay.
And we are both editors with Mint.
Every week, either one of us will attempt to walk you through the most defining development in the world of business, politics, or technology.
Let's dive in.
Hello, welcome and thanks for tuning in. If you have not been living under a rock for the past few weeks, you must have heard the word Bitcoin many, many times. The Indian government even wants to ban it. In fact, all cryptocurrencies. But globally though, crypto is suddenly all the rage. One Bitcoin is worth about $50,000. Other altcoins like Ether and Dogecoin have also been on a roll. More important than the price though is the sudden backing of powerful people and entities that matter. Elon Musk, for instance, or payment networks like PayPal and MasterCard. Where is all of this headed? Can a piece of encrypted code ever become money? And how are things going to play out closer home, in India? I am going to try and unpack some of these complex questions for you today with the help of Ajit Khurana. Now, Ajit has worked as the CEO of an India-based crypto exchange in the past. But these days, he runs a think tank, advising both governments and startups on this crazy new phenomenon called crypto. Welcome to the show, Ajit. So let's talk hypotheticals first. If the Indian government goes ahead and bans all cryptocurrency, what happens?
So I must respond to your question by first saying I generally don't like to talk hypothetically, okay? Because there's just so much that can happen hypothetically. However, since this is of interest to so many people, I will explain my response in two ways. Number one is we need to know the severity of the ban. For instance, there might be curbs, some minimal curbs on Bitcoin or cryptocurrency in various territories. When those curbs are minimal and logical, they are actually called regulation. So that is great. But what we are talking about here today probably is a far more draconian outright ban, to the extent that, if I may be permitted to exaggerate a little, it may start sounding like you can't say Bitcoin, you can't breathe Bitcoin, you can't think about Bitcoin. It's almost the level of paranoia in the users. Some users has reached that point, right? I personally think that if the nature of the ban is such that you can't buy, sell Bitcoin, right? Basically, simply that. Because all other things such as whether you can use Bitcoin only come when you have it, right? So if the basic says you can't possess Bitcoin, if that is the nature of the ban, then basically the legitimate portion of India's economy moves out of the Bitcoin economy. Two consequences occur. Institutions, people who are law-abiding, funds, HNIs, etc., would stay away from it because they don't want the hassle of being labeled a criminal or being in violation of the regulations. And if indeed Bitcoin fulfills its destiny, as Bitcoin believers think it will, then we would have missed the bus entirely, despite the fact that India is actually poised to be a blockchain superpower if regulations are positive. There is a second consequence, and that is that some people may choose pretty much like during prohibition, it is not as if people completely give up alcohol. Some people may choose to do this on the sly, surreptitiously, illegal, black market. I don't know what is the correct word for that. And what that does is that while today, if the government actually encourages lit pools, places where KYC is an Aadhaar PAN number is known, details of transactions are known, and the government can access them whenever they choose for whatever purpose, if this moves underground, then that will also be of no consequence. So I think that basically in both areas, amongst the law-abiding and amongst the non-law-abiding, only bad things will ensue.
But how many if HNIs or private people will have to divest their Bitcoin or other currencies? How many people are we talking about here?
So pretty much using Pareto's principle that, you know, few people tend to have most of the holding. This is true about Indian rupees or US dollars also. If you want to look at an aggregate, this is a guess, and it's based on very sound extrapolations. The number of people we are talking about is 7 to 8 million Indians, which is 70 to 80 lakh people. And the today's value of their holding probably is in the vicinity of around 10,000 crore rupees.
What happens if they have to sell it within, let's say, 3 months or 6 months, which is what some of the leaked draft seems to indicate? Will it actually have a global consequence also?
Let's just, first of all, on this leaked draft bit, so it's not a leaked draft. There was an interministerial committee which drafted a draft bill in February 19, which was published on the government website in August 19. While it may be a leak which may have led to that publishing. Now, what we don't know is whether that August 19 bill is the one that is being proposed in the Lok Sabha. So that is a speculative element. But that bill, which was published by the government, actually specifically says that clause 26A and B, because I've read it so thoroughly, that you have 3 months to dispose it of in the manner recommended by the government. And that is what brings about the entire twist. What is this in the manner? For instance, obviously, an Indian cannot sell in India, right? Because then A would sell to B, would sell to C. We would still be holding Bitcoin in India. So how do you divest? Would they give a one-time waiver to FEMA? Would there be a central agency to who we would transfer? Would they just confiscate? I don't know. So this bit, even in the draft which was published, was just the mention was that the government will tell you how to dispose. Personally, I don't know of any way to dispose short of selling internationally, which you know might have other regulatory repercussions.
So if banning isn't such a great strategy after all, let's talk a bit about regulation. What do you think are the Indian government's main concerns when it comes to crypto, and how can these be addressed?
I think that, frankly, all governments have similar concerns. The difference between one country and another would probably be the government's ability to enforce regulation, right? So, for instance, what are the concerns? One could be capital flight, because Indian rupee is not fully convertible. We have a certain FEMA law, which has a liberalized remittance scheme and other such schemes, ODI, etc., which permit a certain amount of money under certain mechanisms to be sent out. But if people start converting Indian rupee to Bitcoin, they may remit unlimited amounts of money abroad. So capital flight is a concern.
Right.
Second thing is a parallel economy being created, which kind of deprives the government of its fair share of taxation. Right. So that could be the second concern. The third concern would be in the area of consumer protection, that because something is new and induces a huge sense of greed or FOMO, fear of missing out among consumers, their naivety or ignorance might be exploited by bad players who might use this exploit customers. So in the area of consumer protection, I think these would be the three largest. We could go on further. How do you address these? So first and foremost, what you do is that you indicate that every Bitcoin transaction has to begin, I would say cryptocurrency transaction has to begin and end into your bank account. So thereby you can see it, you can trace it. Second, you can list the names or nature of entities with which you can transact, right? So these could be licensed exchanges or what have you. Right. And then those platforms with which you are allowed to interact should be told to report to the government in a certain way, that they have to give the PAN number, Aadhaar number, purchase, sale, whatever volume, whatever the government wants to regulate it should be known. And then they should say that barring these platforms, you cannot, for a peer to peer basis or global exchange or cross border, you can't do it. So that would be a good starting point. And this would basically give government a dashboard to everything that is happening. This would get rid of their first problem of capital flight. It would get rid of their second problem of taxation, because frankly, the exchanges would just say this person made so much money and whatever else, right? As far as the last bit is concerned, that is actually the trickiest, which is how do you protect consumers? The challenge with that is that whose job is it? Like, for example, when mutual funds get together and say mutual funds sahi hai, it is not the government or SEBI who is doing it. It is the mutual funds who are doing it. So I think that the government, pretty much like, you know, the National Stock Exchange collects fines and then uses them for consumer protection or consumer education and stuff. I think that whatever regulation comes in should have a heavy dose of consumer information, consumer education, as we have done in stock, as we have done in mutual funds. Those role models are there. Let's follow those.
Okay. So do you also think is a government or an RBI issued crypto or digital currency, which is being talked about, is that a viable option in your opinion?
So there are two parts to viability, and sometimes you get mixed with those. One, let us look at the technical viability. I think it's highly viable. Like if individual entrepreneurs have come up with these crypto tokens, then a central bank digital currency is very highly viable. I think overnight, and I define overnight as 6 months in this case, technically, we could have a very robust crypto rupee or blockchain rupee or whatever name you might want to give it. The challenge would probably come in the policy bit, because today the government's monetary policy, which is, you know, starts at the department level or the RBI level, is actually distributed through a series of commercial banks, scheduled banks and other intermediaries. What the purpose of having a crypto rupee would be to disintermediate this, right? So, for example, if I want to send money to my friend, today, obviously, I'm not talking of the use of currency notes. If I have to send it remotely, I would use UPI, RTGS, NEFT, whatever, IMPS, etc. Right? Which actually runs through the banking system and creates costs there as well as creates fees there. The purpose of a crypto rupee would be to directly allow a peer-to-peer official digital rupee and thereby disintermediate it, which I think is brilliant. But I think that the number of acts that would have to be amended to allow such a thing to happen. And I know this because I have seen what Singapore has done with UBIN, that is UBIN, which is their CBDC, and the experiments thereon, and the sandbox that they have made, and those kind of things. That requires a major overhaul of, I think that RBI Act would have been impacted, banking related things would be impacted, Coinage Act, legal tender, all of those things will, I think that might be a bigger challenge, as in how do you rework things. But it has been done before. A SEBI was created, right? So an IRDA was created. So I think it is doable, but a time-consuming process.
Now, stepping back a little bit, I also wanted to kind of get a sense of the global perspective here, because crypto is kind of, prices are skyrocketing elsewhere in the world, and there's a lot of attention. Tesla, for instance, recently put some of its cash reserves into Bitcoin. But, you know, nearly a decade after Bitcoin was invented, most reasonable people would still think it's very niche, right? So what is the global outlook for crypto?
Since I have gotten into crypto, one change at a personal level that has happened to me is that I have lost the ability to use words like reasonable people, mature investors, etc. Because what I found is that when people use those words, they really are, you know, displaying their perspective, right? So effectively, those are judgmental words. So I don't know what a reasonable person is anymore. I don't know. So I have sometimes been told that a mature investor would not put money in Bitcoin. And I am 51 years old. I have invested in every asset class. I have been around for every, as in I think I'm very highly mature. So I'm like, great. Cool. But I get the sentiment of your question, and let me react to that. Yes, it is niche. It is not as niche as it was maybe till 14, where probably, you know, the most nerdiest of techies really were able to deal with it. Then layers were created, friendlier platforms were made in the 14, 15, 16 period. So many more people got on board. And indeed, price inflation has been a huge motivator for people to explore this. In fact, even if we look at mainstream media as opposed to crypto media, they tend to get more active around it only when prices go up. Because that's probably when people want. So it's a consumer demand. That is where the consumers want. So obviously all suppliers of information would start waking up at that time. Now, I think that globally, a lot of water is under the bridge. So for example, there are very friendly territories. The payment services bill in Singapore, which is at a macro level, very similar to the payment services bill of India, actually now has sections which refer to directly cryptocurrency. right? They put what is imposed upon and what is not imposed upon. How do you deal with a resident and a non-resident and those kind of things? If you look at the US, while states of New York and Hawaii have crypto-specific regulations, all the others have decided to cover it under their money transferers license. So effectively, there is a licensing scheme. Many other countries such as Australia and Canada have said, no, nothing required. Just make sure you register your services under FinTrack in Canada and AustraTrack in Australia. So there are various solutions that have come up. But the good thing is there are solutions. There is now, as of just a few days ago, maybe 5-7 days ago, ETF which Canada has approved, which would be for the general public. Prior to that also, there were trust structures created for ultra-high net worth individuals who sometimes fall under the ambit of something called accredited investors, which some countries use, India doesn't. So basically what I'm saying is that we have moved ahead. In all of these countries, today as a citizen of the US, I am told that here are the exchanges which are following the US law. You can upload your money from various mechanisms and you can buy Bitcoin and you do the reverse by selling also. And this now covers, while in terms of number of countries which have clarity of regulation, the number of countries may not be very high. But in terms of number of countries and taking their economic worth is concerned, I think that we have now exceeded 85%. So 85% of the world economy is in countries that seem to have some kind of crypto clarity in regulation. I think that is what we want.
On a philosophical note, I mean, there are a lot of people also wonder why should people accept crypto as money, which is essentially like an encrypted code. So in our living memory, money has either been backed by gold or the government. So can crypto realistically kind of replace either of those?
Two things. So let us just see this gold thing, the gold standard, which was kind of abolished by Richard Nixon around 70-71. So we are more than half a century away from that. But yes, this thing about it being backed by the government, I think that is the key here. So for instance, if you were to question why is a 2000 rupee note worth anything, it is worth something because the issuer, the government, the Reserve Bank actually promises to pay the bearer a sum of rupees 2000 and it's written on the note, right? So that means there is a backing. There is somebody who says, I say this is fine, and then you believe that entity, right?
Right.
And that you're right. Historically, whether these were metals or seashells or whatever it was always backed by a central authority granting recognition to that currency. It may not necessarily have been intrinsic worth gold or food or barter system, etc., but definitely some sort of an acceptance. Now, in all of human history, we never had the computing power of digitalization or digital presence of so many human beings. I could today argue that even elected bodies such as members of parliament or members who constitute expert committees in Reserve Bank, etc., all of who are our representatives, why should representatives make the decision? Why not us? The reason is that it was infeasible until now. Today, I think that with the level of digitalization, we can actually put the question directly to the people as opposed to their representatives. This is the philosophical component of money. Basically, if you think about it, let us say the government of India backs the Indian rupee or the Reserve Bank of India administers the monetary policy. Who is government of India? Who is Reserve Bank of India? They are in one form or another elected or selected representatives, correct? That is what they are. By whom? Well, in a democracy, at least by the people. So if the people themselves can administer their own money, which is the philosophical way of looking at Bitcoin, then it is people's money, right? As opposed to people's representatives' money, which is all the money we know today. So philosophically, I think it is sound. It does present an alternative. But I must also, before concluding on this question, point out that using cryptocurrency as a medium of exchange is not its only use case. It potentially can be a store of value. It potentially can be viewed as being something different from money entirely. Like, for example, if a certain government wants to store land records on an immutable database, which we call a blockchain or a public blockchain in this case, they can use some Bitcoin to write onto the Bitcoin blockchain. Now, there was no money usage happening here, right? It was actually a technical way of storing a limited amount of digital fingerprint. So, yes, so Bitcoin does serve a lot of purposes. It is only coincidental that the speculative element of Bitcoin is the only one which is so popular and has the maximum followership.
Okay, well, thanks for joining, Ajit. I think we don't have time for any more questions, although we can keep talking about this for hours. But thank you for unpacking at least some of these complex issues, and thanks for joining.
Thank you very much. I must say that the questions you have touched upon are not the most common questions. So I thank you for that. I'm glad to have these intellectually stimulating questions.
Thanks. Thanks, Ajit. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
You have been listening to The Signal and the Noise. We would love to hear from you. Reach out to us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram on @HTSmartcast.
Or you can also reach out to us personally at Sunita Arora
and @AJAxiom. To listen to more such interesting podcasts, do log on to htsmartcast.com.
We'll be back next week with a new story, another fresh voice, or a unique take on the world.
Do stay well until then, and keep supporting good journalism.
This was a Mint production brought to you by HT Smartcast.
HT Smartcast.
I'm Annie Apple, and I'm here to invite you to come and listen to my new podcast series, Raising a Pro. It's the most intimate sports-related conversations you will hear. Each week, we explore the journeys of some of your favorite NFL players through the eyes of those that know them best. From Joe Burrow, DeAndre Hopkins, Myles Garrett, Ezekiel Elliott, Nick and Joey Bosa, just to name a few. With exclusive insights and information, we leave no stone unturned. Subscribe now to Raising a Pro on your favorite podcast app.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.